Please be seated. This is our final case today, which is case number 71059, State v. Arnold Williams. Ms. Morris for the appellant, Mr. Mueller for the respondent. Ms. Morris.
May I ask that any time I have left over, I could use for rebuttal?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
I said, can I ask that any time I have left over, I could use for rebuttal?
Of course.
Thank you.
Of course.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Chief Deputy District Attorney Lindsay Morris. I'm representing the state in this matter. It is the state's contention. The reason that we brought this before this honorable court is that, first and foremost, the district court did not have the authority to grant a mistrial of prejudice in this action. And second, if in fact your honors find that they did have the authority to grant a mistrial with prejudice, ultimately that is an incorrect remedy given what happened because there was not a constitutional violation. And furthermore, there was no intentional misconduct on behalf of the state. I think the items have been thoroughly briefed for your honors, but essentially the crux of why we're here is the question that Ms. Lavelle asked on redirect. And the reason that Ms. Lavelle got into this question, I was her trial partner in the case, and I'm the one that actually told her to ask the question. Yes, it was an ID case. Identity was the issue in this case. There was no issue that this victim died by virtue of a car crash and that person left the scene. So it wasn't, did the crime occur? It was who committed the crime. Now, Mr. Mueller, in his cross-examination, asked the question, isn't it true, and this is to the Detective Tommaso, that you were told that this was a woman ultimately driving the vehicle, the defendant was a man? We vehemently objected. There was a sidebar. At this point in time, Mr. Mueller showed us a document that we had never seen before, apparently done by one of his investigators in consulting one of the eyewitnesses that said the driver had a lot of hair, so it appeared that it might have been a woman. Now, this had never been disclosed to us, and he was asking the detective such that the detective should have known this, right? Isn't it true that this eyewitness told you the person had a lot of hair? That was nowhere in any of the reports by the detective or anything that the state had in its possession. It could have been very well true that this individual told his private investigator that this person had a lot of hair. So the state, essentially the entire argument that Mr. Mueller was making in his cross-examination was this was faulty police work. Ultimately, you jumped the gun, you went to this defendant, and you had no reason to particularly single him out. There were other individuals at this residence that the house was registered to. Why didn't you question them? Things of this nature. Now, in redirect, we got into things of the nature of, well, when they went to this residence where the home, where the vehicle was registered, were there people that, did they appear to have an elevated heart rate? Because this was very close in time after the accident had occurred. So if, in fact, this car that's dumped 7 blocks from the registered owner's home, if it had been someone at that home and they had to run 7 blocks and the cops arrived shortly thereafter, presumably they would have a high heart rate. So in going through this line of questioning, Ms. Lavelle ultimately gets to the question of, and I told her, I said, Maria, ask about the anonymous tip. That's what directed his investigation. I'm not trying to get in the truth of the matter for it.
Well, but you already had in volume 4 on page 569, this was on the direct. Did you ultimately receive additional information suggestive that Mr. Williams, it's a yes or no question, suggestive that Mr. Williams may have been involved? Answer yes. Mr. Mueller, objection. Court basis. Mueller, hearsay. Court overruled. But then it goes on the next page, and the court says, no, I do think it calls for hearsay. And that was on your direct, and the court ends up sustaining the objection as to hearsay. So when you say you come back in on redirect, and you're wanting to elicit this information, isn't that the same thing the court has already ruled off limits on the direct examination?
Okay. I don't, from being there in the courtroom, I know what you're discussing, and I don't recall that was what particularly Ms. Lavelle was trying to get into. I believe there was some other hearsay issues that we wanted to get into in terms of...
Well, but it's not subjective. It's objective. You have a question of, did you have information that pointed to Mr. Williams? Answer yes or no. Answer yes. Objection, hearsay. Sustained as to the hearsay content. So whether it's a confrontation clause or not, whether or not you're rehabilitating the expert, it strikes me that you did have a sustained objection to that question and then returned to it without asking the court's leave, off the record, anything like that.
Okay.
That's troubling to me.
I understand what you're asking. I think the reason that I told, well, I know the reason that I told Ms. Lavelle to ask that question is because I didn't believe it was in furtherance of a hearsay answer. And I had a discussion off the record with the judge indicating I routinely...
Well, you can't argue outside the record.
No, I understand. I'm just trying to explain. Yeah. Like, I understand that. Routinely in preliminary hearings or in cases where we're trying to establish probable cause or even at trial, very often we'll ask a question, you know, did you receive a call about a domestic violence? Of course I
don't. So this is trial. So, as Justice Speaker was saying, we have a record of what occurred, except for, as you're alluding to, which we always counsel outside the record. Wasn't it clear?
Okay, and I understand that, Your Honor. I guess my response today in front of you would be routinely, even at trial, that question is asked. That involves a hearsay statement, but it's not an attempt to elicit that hearsay statement for the truth of the matter asserted. So I did not believe we were going into the purview.
The problem is just Skipper was pointing out, it was asked, it was sustained. It's not like it's a brand new question that we're starting anew. We have a history. And you're just off stop, just bumping right over it like it's not even there. That's of concern.
I understand what you're saying. I don't believe I know for a fact that that wasn't the intent of the state. There very well could have been, in the course of trial, I didn't have a memory back to that particular sustained objection. But I can tell you that Ms. Lavelle asked that question, not believe she was asking a hearsay question. And I think because it wasn't further fleshed out on the record previously, that is in fact what we were discussing. I didn't believe that we felt we were reopening that door. It wasn't thoroughly fleshed out on the record that we were in fact talking about this anonymous tip. So in the state's purview, we didn't believe that it had been fleshed out, and that's why we asked
counsel,
the question.
Do you now believe it was hearsay?
I don't believe it was hearsay, no.
Why not? Why didn't you tell the court why you don't think it was hearsay?
Well, Your Honor, we would have never, I mean, not even a baby attorney would try to get in an anonymous statement without the declarant available, without some sort of exception. All we were trying to do was show the effect on the listener. Why did you decide to investigate this person more thoroughly? That's all. So definitionally, hearsay is an out-of-court statement offered for the truth of the matter asserted. Never once in a million years would I have stood up in my closing and said, you heard an anonymous person said that this person committed this crime. That's not why it was being offered.
It's almost like dancing on the head of a pin. And looking through this record, you had... It's not like you didn't have anything but that. You had the Walmart receipt. Shows he was driving that evening. There was other identifying material in the car.
Yeah, there was. I mean, I agree. I think in looking at Mr. Mueller's response, he indicates that, well, by this time in trial, we had such weak evidence that we were grasping at straws, and I didn't believe that it wasn't the case. We did have the evidence that you're discussing in terms of the video surveillance, in terms of the fact that he repeatedly had a history of borrowing this car, the fact that he had called earlier in that day and had been refused the right to borrow that car, the closeness and proximity of where it was dropped, where we found, I understand all of that. In the state's view of how the evidence was coming out, it very much so appeared that Mr. Mueller was trying to make the argument that this was shoddy police work and that there wasn't all of these things. So I think I would argue that on the redirect, we were trying to elicit all of the important factors that we had previously discussed.
You're arguing that he opened the door, in effect, by his cross-examination, saying, you just picked this guy because he was easy target.
Correct. And also with the question about the woman with the hair, that we were told we had no idea what he was talking about, and I still argue that that's not really a good faith basis to ask this particular detective, isn't it true you were told it was a woman? Because there was no evidence to support that anywhere whatsoever in the report.
Ms. Morse, let me ask you this. I mean, I understand you've spent the background here in the state's thinking. Judge granted this trial, so the question is, can you retry this guy or not? So my question is there authority for a district court to grant a mistrial with prejudice? And if there is, tell us why you don't think, why he erred and abuses discretion in granting it with prejudice.
Sure. And I think the state laid that out very clearly in our briefs that there is not evidence to support that the district court could grant a mistrial with prejudice. The proper remedy would have been a writ of prohibition in terms of preventing this individual from being retried. And I mean, the general argument is if we have created this mistrial and we've goaded them into this mistrial, then they have no recourse but to ask for the mistrial. And certainly if we did that on purpose, that would be. I don't believe they're supporting a battle law for that, but I would understand that being a mistrial with prejudice, if it's something that we had done, if it was an intentional misconduct by us beyond mere negligence. And I think the Babian case was illustrative in terms of it was dealing with a different issue about dismissing an indictment, but specifically they stated that the state's actions rose beyond mere negligence, that there was actually intentional misconduct.
What's the case that says it had to be a writ of prohibition instead of a motion to dismiss on the basis of double jeopardy?
And that would be the Weber versus 8th Judicial District Court, where it indicates that the writ of prohibition would be correct in that particular. It's on specifically state's brief, page 17.
What were the facts?
I don't know the facts of that case, Your Honor. I apologize.
Would a motion to dismiss on the basis of double jeopardy not be an appropriate remedy also? Is it just writ of prohibition in the district court?
It was my understanding that writ of prohibition was the only remedy, but even if arguing that he had the authority to do this, and let's say that you know, it's totally fine that he granted this mistrial with prejudice, the state, I guess I would submit that isn't even relevant, because to get to that point to where you would dismiss it with prejudice.
But Glover came up because the defense asked for a dismissal with prejudice, which the district court denied, and then they ran a writ. So, of course, a writ of prohibition was appropriate in Glover, but Justice Cherry's point is correct, that there's nothing that says a motion to dismiss with prejudice based on double jeopardy is not available post-Glover. So let's get past that, and you look at Oregon versus Kennedy and Melcher Gloria and those other cases, and they say where the defendant moves for the mistrial, customarily, that's it. He can be retried. But there's this exception for the goaded mistrial, and so this order has that in it. It says the case was going badly for the state. The state deliberately provoked Mr. Mueller into moving for a mistrial, and the state was violating the rules of the game that the court had already established. Is this not a goaded mistrial? And then what's the standard of review for that? What standard of review do we apply to that?
Sure.
I don't know.
At least in my reading of the case is that it would need to be beyond mere negligence, and it would have to have been an intentional act on behalf of the state. And I understand the order, and I think it is a little bit confusing in terms of what the judge actually ordered in being there for all of the conversations and his actual order. So he specifically states that the state knew or should have known that the question would constitute a violation of the Confrontation Clause. But then later on in the record, he also states, here's why I think this motion should be granted. It is not because the court finds any kind of either subjective or objective bad faith on the part of the prosecution. Furthermore, this is not a case, in my view, where a prosecutor has consciously and intentionally thrown a low blow. Additionally, I think Ms. Lavelle is a good prosecutor, and I'm not going to make a ruling that rests upon her bad faith. I don't find that here. So to be perfectly honest, I think that his order is in contradiction with everything else that he ultimately said, that he did not find bad faith, but in terms of drafting this order, it was the necessary language that he felt was appropriate to grant the mistrial with prejudice. I think that he essentially contradicted himself.
The written order does find that the question was tantamount to goading the defense counsel into having to ask for a mistrial.
And I would submit that he was wrong. That was an abuse of discretion, and then that's the standard in terms of what you're looking at. He was wrong. That was not, based on everything else he even himself said in the record, that was not tantamount to goading. That was made in a good faith basis. We didn't believe we were implicating a confrontation clause. We certainly weren't attempting to goad Mr. Mueller into a mistrial, and we certainly didn't feel that there was such lacking of evidence or something to that effect that Mr. Mueller indicated that we felt that we had to go some sort of negative, nefarious route. And I think it's very important that when he states on the record, I don't believe she committed anything of bad faith subjectively or objectively. So I don't know why he's inconsistent in what he said, but that's how it appears to the state that he came up with that statement, was that it just was necessary to grant the mistrial with prejudice. That's as far as the state can understand. So that's the reason that we brought the appeal. I totally understand that the mistrial, I wouldn't have objected to the mistrial, but the mistrial with prejudice, I do believe, was an abuse of discretion. I think that's the standard that Your Honors have to decide. I think that there was no intentional misconduct on behalf of the state. We certainly wouldn't have believed that the judge would have erroneously ruled that the confrontation clause was implicated. It was not a testimonial statement. It wasn't a proffered issue. It wasn't anything of that nature. So we couldn't have intentionally done that if he ultimately made an incorrect ruling. We had no way of knowing that. And for that reason, Your Honor, we would request that you reverse the ruling.
Thank you. Ms. Mueller?
Thank you.
Thank you, Justice. The state's burden here is to show abuse of discretion by the trial court. And the absence of showing of abuse of discretion, then Judge Corey's decision should not be disturbed. Now, some context might be a little, and this court has traditionally granted wide latitude to the trial court. We were in day 5 of this case. We were on the redirect on the last examination of the witness. Then, out of the blue, the state asks about an out-of-court statement by an unknown declarant asserted to rehabilitate Detective Tommaso about an anonymous tip. That, done in the Confrontation Clause violation of both the federal and state constitutions, created a mistrial and the reasonable and certain, in fact, concrete implication to the jury that there was evidence that they had been held back from him, and that they should have convicted Mr. Williams despite what was pretty clearly a very weak circumstantial case against him.
What do you say, though, to the state's position that you cross-examined this detective pretty thoroughly on shoddy police work, and they were trying to rehabilitate the detective's police work and say, you know what, I had factors that directed me to him, it wasn't just accidental that we got to him. And that you open the door. There can be an answer to a question or a question that calls for an answer that's both hearsay and, if not offered for the truth of what it asserts, it has a permissible purpose as well, and then you give a limiting instruction. Why is that a wrong position by the state legally?
It's specifically because the constitutional rights protect Mr. Williams. They belong to him. Now, here specifically, I did take Detective Tommaso, who I actually know and like personally off the record, but I took him to task pretty hard on the witness stand because it was obvious to me that he had not done a thorough investigation of the case. He took this anonymous tip and basically ran over and arrested Mr. Williams. And that's the practical problem. Now, I went through a laundry list.
Other than that, there was more to this, just like the videotape. And the receipts, and just as I had indicated previously, it wasn't just this anonymous tip, and that's all they had.
It was nearly so, Justice. And having done it, here's the practical problem. This car was found moments later after the accident in front of the registered owner's house, or 7 houses down. She didn't have a driver's license, and she was reporting the car stolen as the North Las Vegas Police Department is knocking on the door to find out who had the car. Now, this would have been the quickest cover-up in history, like literally 10, 12 minutes. This was a very weak circumstantial case, and almost all of the evidence was self-serving to protect the registered owner of the car. Now, Detective Tommaso was confronted with a house full of people. There was at least 3 other gentlemen in the house that would have fit the general description of Mr. Williams, who was not actually present. They didn't do a 6-pack photo lineup. They didn't interview them independently. They didn't review anything. They didn't check for DNA. They didn't check for fingerprints. They didn't go talk to Mr. Williams, his employer, and ask for his alibi. None of this was done. That was all fair questionings and all factual allegations that I questioned Detective Tommaso on. I knew, but did not ask about an anonymous tip.
So you knew that was in there. I mean, you knew you sidled right up next to eliciting that.
No, Justice. I knew that he had gotten a tip. That was in the police reports. They never gave me any of the details. Was it a man's voice, a woman's voice, or
sure,
when was it?
You knew, as a matter of fact, that the police had received supposedly an anonymous tip that it was Mr. Williams. Right?
Yes, that was in the police report.
And you knew that when you were cross-examining Detective Tommaso.
Yes. Which is why I didn't. I want to, if I could, Justice, I'd like to talk very briefly actually about what I think the important issue of this case here, which is a public policy decision. Now, the case law, as I learned as a young prosecutor, a defense attorney, is when the defense is goaded into asking for a mistrial, and that's it. Jeopardy is attached. Now, Judge Corey is very thorough and gave a lot of time and effort to this decision. These words were chosen by him with specific understanding of what they meant. He put in here that is objectively tantamount to goading the defense counsel to ask for a mistrial. That was the eyewitnesses, the referee on the field called the play that way. And he said it was tantamount to acting to goad.
Tell me how you analyze goading as opposed as it relates to intentional conduct, and does it make any difference? I mean, you could call almost anything goading. So there's got to be a standard there in the way you evaluate what goading means.
These were two career prosecutors with a significant experience between them. They asked about an anonymous statement on a hearsay tip on redirect at their last witness. Now, there's a very practical policy here. Now, none of us here are kid lawyers. You're a second, third year lawyer, you get in there and sometimes you run your mouth and you say dumb things. When you get to the 25-year mark or 15-year mark, you know exactly what you're doing. When a prosecutor sees their case isn't going well and they can provoke a mistrial and then retry the defendant, that is the evil that is prescribed here. Now, the law in Nevada is actually abundantly clear. And every day in this courthouse down the street, somebody is swearing out a Hill motion or a Bustos motion. This motion to continue is not made for bad faith or for purposes of delay. If it's not, if it is, the case is summarily dismissed. Now, when a prosecutor is in there and asking questions that lead to the willful indifference to the rights of the defendant, specifically his confrontation clause against an anonymous tip, on day five of a trial, I don't know how much more egregious that could become. Now,
what about the permissible purpose for that question? Do you grant me that trying to rehabilitate after you placed in issue the thoroughness of the investigation, trying to rehabilitate the police officer with saying that he had other information that directed him to Mr. Williams is a non-hearsay use of that information?
I respectfully object. I disagree with that conclusion.
Okay, so you think it's pure unadulterated hearsay?
Pure unadulterated hearsay.
Okay.
Now, specifically, detectives all the time get anonymous tips. It is their job. They are funded by the taxpayers to take that anonymous tip and run it to the ground. We have 123 Main Street, large number of people coming and going. We believe they're selling drugs. That's not evidence. That hearsay statement is not evidence. Parking the undercover patrol car in front of 123, getting some cameras, people coming and going. That's evidence. Now, Detective Tommaso got an anonymous tip. Okay. It's his job to turn that into legally admissible evidence. Where was the six-pack lineup of the six guys who were living in the house? He didn't do that. That was the problem. And I reread my cross-examination again, and I went through that. And I think very thoroughly showed that Detective Tommaso's efforts were conclusory. An anonymous tip is not evidence. Had it been evidence, something that you and I would recognize as evidence, then they might objectively have an argument. Now, this is the hearsay exception from law school. Sir Wally Rockett, when the Queen Elizabeth wanted Sir Walter Raleigh's head, a Spanish gentleman said he had committed treason and spoke poorly of the Queen. Well, where was he? Who was he? Could he be confronted? Well, the man literally lost his head on that evidence. Now, that's why we have such a strong revulsion against hearsay evidence. It's from 1535 in English law. Now, the reality is this is a hearsay statement by an unknown declarant being asserted as evidence for the truth of the matter asserted after their lead witness had taken a pretty tough cross-examination. Now, I believe, respectfully, this is a matter of public policy. You get a veteran prosecutor who goes in there and missed something. We're in day four of trial and he's missed something important on an important case. Well, if I go in there and call for a mistrial, I get to do it all over again. Now, that's not law that anybody on this bench would recognize or believe is public policy, but that's tantamount to what's been done here. And maybe in this case, maybe not, but the reality is if you guys give us a reported decision on this case, it will be used in the future. Day six or day seven of a murder trial, we forgot to get the expert in for the DNA courier sample. Well, maybe if I go in there and trip them up on a mistrial, I can retry this murder conviction. Now, that's the public policy that I believe here is at issue. It's a much wider question, which is why I thought or suggested that you guys accepted this case for oral argument, because I believe it's an important issue. Now, we did a lot of research. We couldn't find a specific case on point. We did, however, find lots of law, which we cited, which allows the court to grant a mistrial. That is the standard for which it is abuse of discretion. Justice Corey or Judge Corey was well aware of the case law. He got basically nearly the same brief that you guys got and read it and said it was tantamount, objectively, tantamount to goading defense to ask for a mistrial.
Now, Mr. Mueller, I read the order. I guess your office prepared it and the DA's office signed off on it and submitted to the judge. Did the judge say everything that's in this order in open court?
Yes, Justice, to the best of my recollection, yes. Okay. Justice, I don't want to... My memory is simply not good enough for all the details.
The gist of this order was Ms. Morris was saying that this order is overbroad from what he said. I just wanted to get your take on that.
I don't believe the order was overly broad. It was considered. There was hearing. He didn't grant the mistrial initially. He asked for briefs. We briefed and argued it. And I actually, if I recall right, he actually held it under for a while under consideration. This was a deliberate, not a shoot from the hip sort of thing. Now, Justice Douglas and I did a trial, Cornell Belt, I think it was my first or second trial as a defense attorney, against Billy Kephart, who was the prosecutor. We had a witness who was, we knew had problems keeping his mouth shut on the stand. So we asked, and we actually took a break. Justice gave us a break, told Billy to go out, Judge Kephart to go out and instruct the witness not to say the following things. I walked right past him as I was going to the bathroom. I heard Mr. Kephart say that to him. Walked in, we recalled the trial, and sure enough, the guy says exactly what he's told not to. Mistrial, not with prejudice, gets restudied again. The state hadn't done anything wrong, and I even had the voucher. I vouched for Kephart. He did exactly what the judge told him. I was State of Nevada versus Cornell Belt. I remember it, and you probably don't, only because my first trial as a defense attorney. Now, that's the difference here. That's not this case. This case was provoked by a veteran prosecutor on day four of a ship that's low in the water and starting to roll over on it. And then we start asking about hearsay evidence. I believe that's it's improper, and I believe the wider issue here is whether this can be allowed. It'll come up again, and if you give them a pass on this, or if you reverse Justice Corey, Judge Corey, it's going to be a written opinion, and it's going to come back, and we'll be back up here with a murder conviction or something else where they've got a case that didn't go so well, and, well, there was a mistrial, and we're going to do it all over again. And that's what I believe is the key issue here. This isn't just a run-of-the-mill, the witness said something inappropriate, has to be told not to. This is a prosecutor eliciting, and as the justice pointed out, over, we'd sparred on this issue before. We'd had a few sparks that had already flown and came back to it, and Tommaso had an answer before I could get out of my seat and say objection. Yeah, I don't know if you can't see the transcript, but you know, I was racing for to object, and then he got the answer up. That's where we're at. Now, I believe the statement was hearsay. I don't believe there was any legitimate tactical purposes. Had they wanted to go back on any one of those 8 or 9 points I brought out on cross-examination, they certainly would have been well and able to, and I wouldn't have said a word about it. But this particular comeback was inappropriate and deprived Mr. Williams of his right to confront this witness.
Thank you, Mr. Mueller.
Thank you.
Ms. Morris, I'm going to give you an extra full minute. You've got a little less than that. Full minute.
Very simply, it was not hearsay. This was a question that was not offered to elicit the truth of the matter asserted. It was offered to elicit the effect on the listener, and the door was specifically opened by Mr. Mueller with his question regarding identification. So regardless of the potential hearsay exception or the hearsay objection that had been sustained previously, he absolutely opened that door in his cross, such that the state just asked that question. You didn't even have time to follow up afterwards in terms of, so this directed your investigation, correct? Which is the only reason it was offered. If a statement is, out-of-court statements are made all the time, if they're not offered to prove the truth, they are not hearsay. This is definitionally not hearsay. It was no intentional misconduct by the state, and it was an abuse of discretion for Judge Corey to grant this mistrial with prejudice. Thank you.
Thank you very much to Mr. Mueller and Ms. Morris. Thank you for your argument and your briefs on this matter. This matter stands submitted. We'll recess.